National Security This Week, a weekly look at American national security issues. And now, your host, John Olson.
Good morning. You've joined us for National Security This Week. We get together every Wednesday morning at 9 a.m. to discuss national security. We're fortunate enough to be joined by guests from our local area, from around Minnesota, and from across the nation to help us learn more about American national security. We're going to do something a little different for today's show. We're going to have a bit of a free-form discussion on current events in national security affairs. Joining us for these discussions are two professors who teach international relations. Some of you may recognize Professor Greg Marfleet from the Department of Political Science at Carleton College. Professor Marfleet has been a previous guest on our show. Greg is the Dorothy H. and Edward C. Congdon Professor of Political Science and Director of the Public Policy Program at Carleton College. He teaches courses in international relations, U.S. and comparative foreign policy, security studies, and political leader psychology, as well as classes in statistical and computational methodology. Our other guest is Professor Tony Lott from the Department of Political Science at St. Olaf. Professor Lott joined the department as an assistant professor of political science in 2005. He received his Ph.D. in international studies at the Graduate School of International Studies at the University of Denver in 2002. He's the author of Creating Insecurity, Realism, Constructivism, and U.S. Security Policy, and numerous articles in political science and law journals. His research interests include an exploration of norms and interests in international relations theory, cooperation in global environmental politics, and national and international security policy. Prior to his appointment at St. Olaf, Professor Lott taught at Portland State University, Hamline University, and the University of Glasgow. Tony Lott, welcome to National Security This Week.
Well, thanks very much, John. I appreciate that. It's always fun to sit down with Greg, and nice to meet you.
Yeah, it's good to have you on the show. And Greg Marfleet, welcome back to National Security This Week.
Thanks, John. It's great to be here.
We have a lot to talk about today. We do have a full hour on our show. Gentlemen, I thought we'd have a bit of an open discussion based on what's happening around the world today. There's lots of things going wrong in the world, so we have lots of material to talk about. These are all situations that do impact American national security interests, either directly or indirectly. And I'd like to begin our discussions with the Russian invasion of Ukraine. It seems to be in the news constantly. It is the one thing that has the most direct impact on what's going on. What are your respective thoughts on the current situation with the Russian invasion of Ukraine? Tony, I'll start with you.
Oh, sure. I don't think that we can underestimate the importance of this particular conflict. I think sometimes we professors get stuck in the mindset of looking at whatever's on the front page of the newspaper, and that becomes the issue du jour. But this is a particular issue that is challenging to the post-World War II global architecture.
Yeah.
It's a challenge to the way globalization has been acting in the last 20 years, even prior to the pandemic. It has implications for some of the most important and entrenched institutions that we look to in the world for stability and security. So I am real concerned about this particular conflict. I don't think we can underestimate the implications for this short-term and long-term.
Yeah. Greg?
Yeah, I totally agree with Tony. This is one of those watershed moments, I think, in our sort of modern history that's changed the way we think about the world. And, you know, after 9/11, American security focus and even international relations theory and foreign policy people started to focus more on non-traditional security threats, you know, non-state actors and as a security threat. And you could find articles, you know, and papers saying, you know, modern war is obsolete, you know, and that kind of thing. And there was, and so to see, you know, ground warfare occurring in Europe again is a little stunning. And I think, a bit of a corrective for a lot of the thoughts that, you know, the world is moving towards this kind of like post-conflict thing, and notwithstanding the U.S. invasion of Iraq, I suppose, right? Which
yeah.
But I think this is a bit of a wake-up call in terms of where our focus is on security questions again, and we're back to, and I think it is also a challenge to what was kind of like the universal liberal order that we were kind of building, and an articulation of a sort of new time of multipolarity, and that's what the Russians really want, I think, and the Chinese really want, and maybe both the Brazilians and the Indians also want. And so, yeah. I think there's a couple of signals here about conflict and about power.
I think what I just heard from both of you is a sort of a discussion on upsetting the balance of the world order that has been in place since the end of World War II, a time. You know, all of the structures that existed out there were very beneficial to the United States. And you have a lot of rising powers out there that say, hey, we want to change the rules a little bit. They may not do it directly, but they see what's happening with Russia and they say, hey, this is upsetting, you know, the old World War II post-World War II security order. And we could benefit from this because in confusion, there is profit. Maybe we should start with let's start down sort of the tactical level. The battle space in Ukraine, what's happening on the ground, maybe what you see, and then let's branch out and consider kind of what the ramifications are to the broader region, and then maybe the third and fourth order impacts on the world from this conflict. Tony, what do you see happening on the ground right now in Ukraine that is particularly of interest?
Well, Greg made an interesting point about this new land war in Asia. I'm reminded of the old Princess Bride line, right? Don't start a land war in Asia. And the Russians are finding that out in a pretty horrific way. And I think one of the things that I've been noticing is that there are instances of old World War I sorts of behavior, trench warfare in the east part of Ukraine right now, which... it's 2022. I didn't think that we would see that again. Yeah. So that's surprising to me that we're seeing the Russians hunkered down in long trenches between fields and trying to protect themselves in ways that are just not working with the equipment that the Ukrainians have right now. I am seeing a tentative move by the Ukrainians to move east, and it's hard to tell because we just don't have good information right now as to how well that's going and what the objectives are. So those are two issues that, to me right now, I think are interesting to watch. And then as we watch, Greg brought up kind of these other security issues, the human security issue right now, watching Ukrainians being moved out of the region, both into Russia, as well as trying to make their way back to safer Ukrainian lines. It's a very sobering thing to watch right now.
Yeah. Greg, how about you?
Yeah, you know, there's an international relations theory angle to this, whether you want to go down that rabbit hole. But one of the arguments that has been made over time is about rationality in international politics. Are states rational actors, and is war a rational activity? And the arguments generally have been something along the lines of war shouldn't really occur, because before a war occurs, each side should be able to look at the capabilities of the other and then arrive at some agreement that would avoid war, knowing what the outcome is going to be based on the relative strengths. And I think, you know, the Ukraine invasion throws that out the window. Clearly, you know, the Russians were like 10 times more powerful than the Ukrainians on paper, right? And then it didn't work out that way. And why is a great question, you know. What did Putin expect? I think it goes back to Euromaidan crisis 2014, you know, Yanukovych, the election, and then his sort of being deposed. And I think the Russian reading of that was that maybe there was more division in the Ukrainian society than there is. And when they invaded, they didn't expect the resistance to be quite as strong as it was. And then Ukrainians seemed much more unified and much more willing to fight than I think that he thought that the society would indicate. They had a different reading on the politics of it, I think. And now they're in a situation where they haven't been able to make any inroads militarily. They did at first, and now they're kind of on the backside of that, and the counteroffensive from the Ukrainians is pushing hard, and we'll see how far that goes, whether they can take Crimea back. You know, that would be stunning. What a stunning loss that would be to have that occur. But where I think the rationalists on international politics get it right is that war is a bargaining exercise, and it really is about signaling your resolve and establishing a position for negotiations. And maybe we're in that situation now where the Ukrainians in their counteroffensive are going to push the Russians back far enough, maybe take Crimea, Mariupol, parts of Donbass back. which could force the Russians to the bargaining table, right, and say, look, okay, we've failed. This is turning really bad, and before it gets any worse, we're going to negotiate. I think it's interesting that the international community has not done things like charged Putin and Russia with crimes of aggression, right? Tony's the international law expert. I'll defer to him on this. But you know, that hasn't happened, and that hasn't happened for a reason, right?
Right. No, I think that's exactly right, Greg. And I keep on trying to figure out what the end game is here. And how does Putin get Russia out of this particular mess? And there has been sufficient restraint by the international community not to charge him with crimes of aggression, although we hear it all the time from various actors, right? And to keep the ICC out of the situation as much as possible. So there is a way here that you can see the vestiges of this post-World War II architecture attempting to find a way through the current situation.
Try to keep the norms
trying
that
to keep
we've
the
established
norms.
Over
That's
the last
right.
25, 30 years.
That's right.
It'd be interesting to think about who might be the interlocutor, the intermediary that might be able to pull off these negotiations at the end.
I mean, Turkey has inserted themselves pretty effectively into a lot of the negotiations so far.
And I think their position sort of vis-a-vis NATO of being in but not entirely in, and the relationship they built with the Russians signals that they might be the actor that could do that. But they'd have to be seen as kind of like that neutral arbiter on some of this, or at least an entity that can bring together the sides. But we're still a long way, I think, away from that, and a lot of human suffering away from that too. Yeah. So
let's expand out a little bit from the battlefront right there in Ukraine. How do you see this playing out, kind of regionally, say from the EU perspective, or more broadly with the other nation states in what's referred to as Russia's near abroad, right? Any thoughts on that?
Well, Greg brought up the idea of rational choice theory and rational actor models of international relations. And I think that one could make the claim that Putin was looking at this situation and thinking, how can I weaken the EU, given allies or certainly those who have certain affinities for his policies in Hungary and elsewhere in the EU? And how can I divide the kind of the southern Asian region as well? And he really made a mistake.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know how we can't overstate that. This was a clear mistake. This unified the EU in ways that I don't think anybody in international relations or in public affairs would have thought possible. It brought Sweden and Finland into NATO.
Right.
It did things that no one was even contemplating in international relations.
The Germans increased their defense budget.
Germans increased their defense budget. That's right. Yeah. Exactly.
When you can trigger that kind of activity, that's pretty severe. And, you know, I think Putin just recently came out with his Putin doctrine. I don't know if you saw that. And it's he sort of listed a bunch of things that Russia wants to do. It's not available in English, so I'm relying on some translations to this. But, you know, one of the things, increase the global perception, improve the global perception of Russia was on his list. Well, this clearly is not working. I mean, they've got some. But one of the things that he emphasized was Slavic unity.
Mm-hmm.
So there's still, I think, aspirations to try to pull the Slavic states out of the EU orbit. You know, that's still present there for him. But Tony's right. The unity we see in the West right now is probably stronger than it's been in a long time. I think it speaks to an interesting question about NATO in particular. We may talk more about that. But, you know, anybody out there who's paying attention to sort of the IR literature or the figures may have heard of a guy named John Mearsheimer, right? And Mearsheimer was one of those people who was a NATO skeptic for a long, long time. And it's his commentary on some of this is interesting in that I don't think he expected NATO to stick around after the end of the Cold War, and now it's expanding,
right,
which runs totally counter to everything he had claimed was going to occur. And you have to ask, like, why? And is it now it's back to security issues again, right?
And
so the notion that NATO was obsolete was sort of predicated on the idea that Russia was tamed, and it wasn't, you know? And I think that's It's an important lesson, I think, for international relations, American foreign policy. Just because the world looks the way it does now doesn't mean it's going to look that way in 10 or 20 years, right? And we might see changes in the domestic politics in India, China, Brazil, Russia, or other places that are of security concerns. And so you have to be constantly aware of where the capabilities are, what the potential threats are, and never stop to think that we've conquered the world, or that, you know, the world's a safe place necessarily.
Yeah, it's a constantly changing environment out there, and every single, it's sort of like when I teach a course on policy and strategy, kind of a thing, I try to explain to the students that every nation that's out there is a chess grandmaster. And you know how grandmasters will play, you know, 30 or 40 people at the same time? Well, now you're really talking on the international stage. Everybody's a chess grandmaster, and they're all playing chess against each other all the time, seeking, you know, advantage on the chessboard. Very quickly for our audience, this is National Security This Week, and I'm your host, John Olson. Our guests today are Professor Tony Lott from the College of St. Olaf and Professor Greg Marfleet from Carleton College, and we're discussing current national security affairs around the world. So you had mentioned, Greg, NATO, you know, really back to a strong security framework. I do want to cover that a little bit more as we move through our discussions today. But I would like to shift over to Iran. Mm-hmm. We are maybe close to having a new Iranian nuclear deal. Let's talk a little bit about that. Is this, considering all the other things that are going on in the world, especially the Ukraine situation, the challenges with China and Taiwan, some instability across Africa, which we'll talk about, I think, a little bit, and then all the other things that are happening, is this a good time for the Biden administration to be so focused on, you know, achieving a new Iranian nuclear agreement? I mean, there's a lot of things going on in the world. Is this a good use of the Biden administration's time and resources to achieve a new nuclear agreement? I'll kick it to either one of you who wants to start.
Well, thanks, Greg. No, and yeah. You have to play the hands you're dealt.
Yeah.
So I think, given that if we think about this as a long game, and we put together some program to deal with Iran during the Bush and then Obama administrations, there's the hiccup during the Trump administration, and now we're going to continue the game. How do we put those pieces back together and find a way to, and this goes back to the context of that liberal international order that we were just talking about with Ukraine and Russia. If you're playing by those rules, if the norms are still the post-World War II liberal international norms, then how do you bring Iran back into the fold after 1979, which is what we're still dealing with? We're still dealing with 1979. Right. Yeah.
For America, I think that's absolutely true. There's a psychological component for many people in our country of still we're still very angry about the 79 revolution and taking our hostages at the U.S. embassy.
That's right. Yeah. And I think that last point, taking the embassy, right? That was that went against international law. That went against international norms. And so, how do you bring Iran back in a way that will work? And so that's where we are right now. I think you have to continue playing the game, but it's tough, and this is not the right time to be playing it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I generally agree. I think the adage of all politics being local kind of throws itself in here. You know, this is, in some ways, I think Biden's pursuing this because Trump abandoned it, and some of the people in his circle want to see us get back on track, and it might be a political win for Biden. You know, publicly it polls well. Would a nuclear agreement with Iran be a good idea? Yeah, generally. And so this might be something going into the midterm elections that could be counted as a success. But yeah, I think the timing of it is probably not the best. And the danger is, I think, that Russia has tried to interject itself into the nuclear negotiations in a big way. And, you know, and I think they're using it largely as a way of trying to maybe join in and get to really close to an agreement, and then at the last minute maybe try to throw in a demand for some sanctions reduction or something along those lines in order to get something for them. Like, what's in it for the Russians to contribute to, you know, nuclear nonproliferation in the Middle East? They actually have some advantage in terms of selling weapons to Iran and other things like that. So you know, I'm afraid that the timing's not the greatest, the reasoning may not be the greatest, and the potential for sort of Russian slippage on some of this stuff through interference is a door that's been opened that's probably not the best plan.
Yeah, Iran has long been sort of a client state of Russia, as much like Syria has been a client state of Russia for a very long time. I'll throw this at you, at both of you. We know that the Iranians have sort of been moving back in the direction of you know, really moving forward on their nuclear program. Mm-hmm. Israel, of course, is deeply concerned about that advancement. Is part of this move on the part of the Biden administration to prevent Israel from attacking Iran, to prevent them from actually carrying through on establishing a nuclear program? Because here's my thinking. The United States has been trying to get out of the Middle East for a very long time.
Yep.
And we continuously get pulled back in for various reasons, strategic reasons, economics driven for the most part. And if Israel attacks Iran, now you're talking about potentially a major conflagration all across the Middle East. What do you think? Is that a strategic calculation on the part of
the Israelis? I wonder if the Israelis would be restrained at all.
I don't think they would.
I think that the first part of it is like, even if this happens, if Israel sees a threat, they're going to act on it any case. So it might put them in a position where they don't quite have the high ground on this and say, oh, we're going to attack. Well, we just came up with an agreement. You should not. But I don't think it would hinder them.
I agree. And I go back to John's point about playing chess, right? We're looking at a number of different chess games going on for local reasons, like you said, Greg, but a number of different chess games. And in some ways, they're still connected to the Ukraine-Russia issue because Russia is involved in this particular situation. And I think they are going to use whatever influence they have to complicate the problem. And
I wonder a little bit whether maybe the energy dimension of this matters as well. I mean, if we can get to a situation where Iran's sort of playing by the norms to some degree, right, we can lift some sanctions. And in the current kind of energy crunch that we're facing with Russian oil and gas being cut off, we would open up another potential source of it. I'm not sure if anybody's thinking along those lines. That might be the one kind of thing we might get as a benefit out of this. Europe clearly needs to diversify its energy sources, right?
They're working on that.
They are working on it, right? And I think that's going to make. We're going to talk a little about Africa, and I think that's going to come up there as well. You know, the drive for energy outside of Russia is going to be a big deal, and it's going to drive politics in Africa, I think, as well. But I wonder if maybe at the back of the minds of some that if we can get a deal with the Iranians, we might be able to get a little bit more out of the Middle East in terms of energy production and stability and stuff like that. But that's a long way off, too.
I think geopolitically, if you look at Iran, Iraq, Saudi Arabia, it's always been problematic not to have the United States interested in Iran, right? Which takes us back to 79.
Right.
and the problems that then caused. But, you know, when you look at the population and the energy capacity and all of the issues that just from a geopolitical standpoint, the United States might want to consider, it's problematic that we don't have a better relationship with Iran, and it complicates so many other issues in that region.
Yeah, the Middle East region to me has been this. I mean, it's such a complex situation overall. I mean, there are at this point three countries really jockeying for hegemony in the region. It used to be just two, Saudi Arabia and Iran.
Right.
But clearly, Turkey has inserted themselves as a major player, not just in the Middle East region, where they would like to have a great deal more influence, but in North Africa as well.
Yeah.
So, and, you know, Israel is always figuring into the equation there.
Yeah. UAE, lately, too.
Yeah.
They've become a kind of a wild card with military capabilities, and they're involved in Ethiopia, and they're involved. It's way more complicated, you know. Yeah. Actually, to build on Tony's point, I think one of the interesting things that we may not be attuned to enough is the way that these regional powers like Iran have aspirations for kind of regional hegemony or regional influence, right? Spheres of influence was sort of the terminology that gets played around with during the sort of multipolar eras. And there was some degree of respect for the spheres of influence of the other great powers. And You can see Russia's activity in the Ukraine, you know, as we wanted to establish a sphere of influence. We're going to try to create a sort of puppet regime, and it didn't work out electorally, so now we have no choice but to go and do it the other way. And I think Iran is the same way. The Saudis are the same way, trying to establish spheres of influence in the region. And, you know, I think we may have to come to a point where we say, look, we understand the Iranians want a sphere of influence. And if you want to take over Afghanistan politically, you know, and deal with that mess, that's your problem. Right. And,
yeah.
We know you're in Syria and we know you're in Iraq. And so let's just sit and talk about how we want this all to play out for the benefit of all of us and stability. Right. And I we're not at that stage, I think, where we're ready to play the great power game and start to recognize that. Maybe with China, we're seeing it too. You know, China's going to develop its sphere of influence. We keep resisting it in the South China Sea and Taiwan, right? But I think whether we can switch the mindset towards that kind of a world or not, or whether we want to, that's a very kind of Machiavellian, you know, world of great power politics. But we may be headed there.
It is. And had this conversation happened a year ago, we would not be talking about this realpolitik, sphere of influence,
right,
Machiavellian
right.
world. We would still be talking about how institutional capacity is growing, and there are attempts to kind of create this much more globalized, interdependent world.
Right.
So I think it is a moment to reflect on what has happened just in the last 6 months.
Yeah, the Russian invasion of Ukraine really fundamentally changed the world.
The deck, yeah.
It really did.
Yeah.
I mean, I would say, and I've said this you know, to other people in private conversations, the knowledge amongst the national security community that there was this struggle between the liberal democratic order, the sort of the post-World War II international security framework, and sort of the rising autocratic nations of the world, that was sort of like below the tabletop.
Right.
Everybody kind of knew what was going on,
right.
but nobody was really – they didn't really want to talk about it.
That's right.
And now it is absolutely out there above the tabletop. Everybody sees it. It's there across the world. And the struggle that's taking place right now – whoever wins gets to write the new rules for the world order.
Right.
So who do we want to win that struggle, right?
Yeah. Well, and it's happening at a time when the world should probably be paying significant attention to some other issues which are security related as well, like global climate change.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's coming at a time when we're not looking at 1850 or 1950. We're looking at a world that is...
And the scary thing is most of these autocratic nations that we're talking about, most of them, their entire economy is based on oil and natural gas.
That's right.
Right?
Right.
Yep.
Which means that they can't survive if we change over from those fuel sources for energy.
It's an interesting question to think about, like, what kind of world order Russia would build or China would build compared to the liberal order that the United States and its allies built after World War II. It seems to be a much more clientelistic kind of model, right? Again, the sort of spheres of influence, you know. Russia doesn't want a world order. Russia wants its interests and its clients and its vassal states. And China is doing the same thing. It's going to buy its way into Africa and establish those, you know. And that's a good transition.
Fantastic transition, because I wanted to ask both of you about Africa. If we look at Africa, we're seeing significant instability across many parts of Africa, more than we've seen across the continent in some time. In a couple of weeks, I'll have Dr. Mark Dietz on the show to discuss the Nile River Basin specifically. But what do the two of you think about the influence of Russia and China on the politics and the security situation in Africa right now? We all know that the Wagner Group, which is sort of a Russian mercenary force. They're not. I mean, they're listed as a private military contractor, but they specifically do the bidding of the Kremlin wherever they're sent. They're hard at work putting down political opposition in some nations. The Islamic State and Al Qaeda adherents are still stirring up a great deal of trouble across the continent, and we've seen coup attempts in Russia, in Africa, different countries in Africa. Some of them have been successful. Which nations in Africa have your greatest attention right now? Greg, I'll start with you.
Oh, okay. Well, you know, the United States just recently produced a U.S. strategy for sub-Saharan Africa, released in August 2022. So it's like hot off the presses. And you know, in many ways, it's what you'd expect to see. You know, we want to foster open societies. We want to foster democracies for the potential security dividends. We want to help rebuild after the pandemic and support conservation and climate. Those are like the top four lists. And it's I think it's aspirational, but a little naive, that document. You know, they. It's clear that regimes a little bit of sort of back to the future in Africa. There's a lot of talk about the future of Africa, like 10 years ago, 15 years ago, and economic growth, and everybody thought we're going to get the sort of post Cold War peace dividend, and Africa is going to finally emerge out of the Cold War problem, the proxy fights that were going on there, and that we were going to see an African century, right? And now we're kind of back to where we were, and it's these sort of the meddling of the great powers to some extent, and it's also essentially kind of corrupt regimes who, rather than sort of take the U.S. position about democracy and openness, or rather they would take, let's take the Chinese money and let's take the Russian arms and let's, you know, do our thing and not have to worry about international norms and human rights and democracy and openness and all the things that are troubling for us because we want to maintain our kleptocracies or our corrupt regimes. And so, you know, there's a number of places. Uganda recently, you know, has sort of cozied up with China on a number of issues, despite the fact that we supported their government for 30 years. Now they're, you know, buying Russian arms. The places that are really troubling are Ethiopia is I think, there's been an ongoing civil conflict, Tigrayan forces in Eritrea versus the Amhara and Amharan people, and that's one where Russian arms and Chinese money are, you know, fomenting a civil conflict to some degree, and they're both benefiting from that chaos that's being generated there. And the potential humanitarian danger of that situation is enormous, because you may have read, Somalia is currently experiencing drought conditions, and the knock-on effects of the Ukraine invasion with regard to global food prices and wheat exports are hitting hard in those regions. And if we see an emergence of more conflict there in combination with a climate-induced famine, we're back to the 90s. We're back to, mass starvation in the Horn of Africa. That's very dangerous. So keeping track of that, of what's going on in Ethiopia, I think, should be at one of the top of our list. Yeah. Do you want to do another one? Go ahead.
John, I was afraid at some point during this conversation I would follow Greg and his encyclopedic knowledge of a region and then have to to talk about it. I will say I am looking at Somalia. There are a few kind of bellwether states that I'm looking at across a very vast expansive and divergent continent. But I'm looking at Somalia and looking at the humanitarian crisis that I think we're seeing unfold right now. There was this brief moment just at the end of last year where it appeared that Somalia was actually beginning to kind of entrench some of its institutional foundations in a way that was going to make it a success story for this decade. It had just completed an ICJ, an International Court of Justice case with Kenya over a maritime dispute. Things were looking good that way. So internationally, it had a little bit of gravitas. And internally, it was seeming to coalesce around this idea of statehood. And now we're looking at a famine and a food crisis that could rival that of the 80s and 90s. Yeah. And that, I think, is really going to be difficult. And then, of course, the internal political disruptions that are occurring as a result of that and for other reasons. So Somalia is a state that I'm concerned about. Greg mentioned Uganda. I'm always interested in the Democratic Republic of Congo just because of its mineral wealth and the vastness of that state. So I look there to see how security issues are going to be dealt with.
The other thing to keep on the radar is the way energy is going to play out. Yep. This global energy crisis is going to have geostrategic implications.
That's right.
And one of them, I think, that we might want to follow is Libya. Mm-hmm. So Libya came out of the Arab Spring and was sort of enmeshed in this East versus West civil conflict, right, for quite a while. And then in 2020, 2021, they formed a national unity government. And then they delayed elections. And then there was internal struggle between the ones who control the parliament and the presidency, and they elected a new prime minister, and the president rejected that person. And so they're stuck. There's this sort of east-west division in Libya. Now, if you look at Libya, it's one of the major energy suppliers in Africa. And in 2010, before the Arab Spring, they were exporting something like 10,000 cubic meters of natural gas every year. And then after the Arab Spring and during the conflict, that dropped to like 3,000 or 4,000 cubic meters a year. So a huge cut in energy.
Yeah.
And they've just started to increase supply again. So they hit 8,000 this year, which is almost to the pre-Arab Spring level. And I think BP just sold out to an Italian firm. And so there's clearly like new investment occurring there. But whatever is holding that country together right now might not hold together for long, and we could be seeing that again, and then a diminishing, you know, energy thing. And I think energy is going to drive it. Energy in Nigeria, energy in Libya, energy in, you know, Equatorial Guinea and the countries that produce oil, not to mention the mineral wealth. This Africa is a place where there's going to be a lot of contestation to access that energy. Who's going to control it? Is it going to be China? Is it going to be the Europeans? And how is political stability or instability going to play into supply disruptions? This is big stuff.
I agree. I think that's right. And, you know, we talked earlier about the unity of the EU. But when you kind of peel away the onions skins, you kind of see how it is that the European Union is attempting to manage the current energy crisis. So what is Germany doing? What are the Nordic countries doing? What is France doing? And so some states are interested in restarting their nuclear facilities.
Yeah. Germany just extended the life of two of their nuclear plants.
That's right. Exactly. Yeah. Yep.
France too. Yeah.
And France, exactly. Yeah. And then the Iberian Peninsula and Italy, they're looking down to North Africa now,
yep.
Right? And so they're thinking of how can we get the carbon up into the European supply. So it's interesting to watch how, even though there is unity and there isn't conflict as a result of this, but it's interesting to watch how they have different policies with respect to how to manage these energy issues. And it's going to be a long winter.
Right. Yeah. I mean, that's the key. They're scrambling right now to make sure that they have a reliable supply heading into the winter because they know, well, two things. They know they can't rely on the Russian supply, and
that's
they don't want to rely on the Russian supply.
That's exactly right.
They're trying to cut that off.
Talk about, like, Back to the Future. I don't know if you recall the 80s discussion about the early pipelines to Europe for the Russians and, you know, the export control acts that the Reagan administration put in place. And there was concern that, you know, if Western Europe at the time becomes dependent on Russian oil, they'll have a handle to the pan, you know, on European politics. And we're back. We're back. It's like the Cold War again in some ways, you know.
It is.
The way the Ukraine invasion just sort of transformed us and in some ways kicked us back to a pre, you know, end of the Cold War world as geostrategic rivalry again.
Yeah, it's interesting because, I mean, both of you mentioned this earlier, but if we go back very briefly to the Russian invasion of Ukraine, the speed with which the liberal democracies of the world acted to punish Russia for this, the sanctions and whatnot, it was just remarkable. And it has caused, I think, a fundamental shift in thinking about, well, who do we want to do business with, right, around the world? And the sanctions might lead to less of a globally integrated economy and more to maybe a regionally integrated economy around the world for reliable supply chain purposes. I think the heavy reliance that the United States has had on China, maybe we're realizing that that's probably not a good idea. And maybe it's not a single regional supply chain, but overlapping regional supply chains that give you diversity in the supply chain and resilience in the supply chain based on potential disruptions that are out there. Very briefly for our audience, this is National Security This Week, and I'm your host, John Olson. Our guests today are Professor Tony Lott from the College of St. Olaf and Professor Greg Marfleet from Carleton College, and we're discussing current national security affairs around the world. Anything else that either of you want to talk about with regards to Africa?
Well, I mean, I think Africa is indicative of something that I think we're going to see in a bunch of places, and that is the sort of reemergence of this Cold War. It's Russia, it's the West. That narrative is, as it was in the Cold War, going to be resisted, right? There was always the non-aligned movement that said, hey, we really don't want to have to make a decision in this fight, right? And so while this is going on in Europe, and we're asked to respect the sanctions or comply with the sanctions regime. We really don't want to do that. We want to continue to buy Russian arms and oil. We want to continue, you know, and China's kind of that way too. They don't really want to get, you know, too deeply involved in this. They want to continue their business. And so I think is a little, again, the back to the future thing. We're going to see the sort of non-aligned thing happening as well. And, you know, maybe that's part of the new global economy is a recognition of some of this. So, yeah.
Any thoughts, Tony?
Well, I think that's right. I also think that what we're seeing is a much more sophisticated set of state actors in Africa, too. And that goes along with what you were saying, Greg. But they have the ability to manage their diplomatic relations among other states now in a way that they just didn't have during the confines of the Cold War. And in many instances, I think that they have a much more developed set of institutional components within the state. Mm-hmm. And so I think what we're seeing is a very diverse group of states acting in a much more multilateral way, right? And so for me, that's it's interesting to watch. But I don't have any conclusions for you, right? Because I just don't know where some of these foreign policies are then going to take these states.
Yeah. What I find really interesting about it is that, you know, you just had pretty much a peaceful transition of power in Kenya.
Yeah.
Right.
Kenya
right.
is a really important nation across the African Union.
It is.
Right? Because they are sort of a holdover from the old days of the British Empire, but they have really embraced the traditions of liberal democracy as how they hold their elections. South Africa is a really influential country. Egypt is maybe not a great example of true democracy, but they're very stable and very influential in the region. That's the right. African Union actually signed an agreement not long ago about establishing a free trade region all across Africa. That's huge. I mean, if they can break down some of the individual, you know, border challenges, could create their own, essentially like the European Union as far as the trade goes.
And they're taking the lead on the Ethiopian peace talks as well.
That's right.
They want
a
sort of African solution to the problem.
Yeah. Exactly.
And that's the sort of the void created by some of the Western tensions in the Western and Russian and Chinese environment. It's going to create an opportunity for sort of new political orders to emerge.
That's right.
Generically out of the.
Yep. And in West Africa, we have Sierra Leone, which came out of what was a devastating war and has put itself back together and has the opportunity to provide some leadership in that region of the world, too.
With 50-some countries across the African continent, each one has its own unique story.
That's right.
And they're all fascinating. Yeah. But we only have about 16 minutes or so left. Okay. I want to very briefly cover Myanmar, and then we move on to China, I think. How do you see the situation in Myanmar playing out in the near term and the long term? Maybe talk about some of the influences on the military junta in Myanmar and why those influences matter to American national security interests. Tony, I'll start with you.
Well, John, I think one word, China.
Yeah.
I think if we're looking at influences on the junta, it seems to me that China has an oversized hand here to play, and they're going to play it. And what we saw over the last three years is a realignment with Chinese interests. Mm-hmm. And I think I don't know that I have that much to say about the trajectory of Myanmar without discussing the Chinese context and what it is that the Chinese want out of the situation. Mm-hmm. As we come out of the COVID situation and as we get the supply chains that we were just talking about back into some working order, I think we're going to see that relationship between China and Myanmar solidified even more. That's just my hypothesis, Greg. I don't know what your thoughts are.
I mean, I think Myanmar is China's Ukraine in some ways, right? China's biggest concern geostrategically is India for the most part, right? And that's been a long-standing conflict, and they came to blows, I guess, a year ago, roughly. Was it no shots were fired, but, you know, that and I think I see, you know, great powers establishing buffer zones, and I think that's what's happening with China and Myanmar, and that they're going to do what they can to create this buffer. They don't want that country to be in the sphere of the Indians, for sure.
Right.
And so they're going to establish their boundaries and border states, and that's what's happening. And it's pretty tragic, you know, in terms of what Aung San Suu Kyi just sentenced to 3 more years of labor, you know, on top of 17 years of sentence already. So there's no indication that the military regime is in any way moving towards liberalization. It's getting more and more extreme and cracking down more and more violent. All that adding up to a pretty dismal situation. But yeah, it's great power politics again.
And I don't see the U.S. playing a role in trying to move the junta back towards that liberal democratic order.
Not openly.
No.
That's no. Right.
There might be other things going on.
That's right.
There.
Yep.
But both of you bring up a good point. It's really China is the key player on that stage in Myanmar. But China is also a key player elsewhere. We have about, let's spend the rest of the show today talking about sort of the tensions that are between the U.S. and China. China and Chinese regional influence around their country. Where do things go from here? I mean, the policy strategy match that the U.S. needs to establish to ratchet down tensions right now, because they are pretty high between the U.S. and China, and yet still provide security to Taiwan. We just saw a $1.1 billion arms deal with Taiwan, where we're going to send them some pretty high-end sophisticated weaponry. Taiwan is a nation with a really high-functioning, democratically elected government. Mm-hmm. They're a nation that's critical to the international microchip industry. I mean, and everything relies on microchips today. Yeah. Where do you guys see this going? I mean, maybe frame it kind of what you see happening right now, and then maybe we come up with some solutions for how we ratchet down tensions. Tony, why don't we start with you?
Well, I've always been persuaded as an IR scholar towards the realist perspective, which is really based on power and interests of states. But I don't know who it was that used this phrase, but someone years ago used the phrase that realists were the cautious paranoids of international relations. They were always cautious in the fact that they were reticent to use the equipment that they had, right? The military and economic resources that they had, but they saw security threats under every rock and behind every tree. Mm-hmm. And if we take that vision of what's going on into the Chinese-U.S. relationship right now, especially in the East China Sea, it seems to me that this is playing out in a way that I really, really wish it wouldn't.
Yeah.
And I'm concerned about the fact that neither side is willing to sit down and have an open dialogue around a table seriously about these issues. Rather, we're going to signal with some really impressive weaponry. And it just seems to me that probably a cautious paranoid myself, but I'm concerned about the use of some of the instruments that we're using to signal our diplomatic interests. And when I say we, I mean the United States and China in this particular region.
Deterrence heavy in the communication that I think we're
seeing.
That's right.
That's right. Exactly.
You know, again, come back to all politics is local, right? I think China's facing some serious domestic headwinds.
They are.
Right.
Yeah.
They've had this incredible heat wave, the record-setting temperatures and drought, drying up rivers. And then they're still dealing with a lot of COVID lockdown and post-pandemic rebuilding. And their economy has started to get that diminishing returns effect where you can't grow at 10% forever. So they're starting to slow down. And that, I think, all presses on Chinese leadership to do something. Now, the classic thing for states to do in those instances is maybe deflect attention to the domestic problems by focusing on some international problem. And they did that with China in the past and, you know, riled up Chinese nationalism, or did it with Japan, sorry, in the past and riled up Chinese nationalism. And I think Taiwan is kind of like the latest thing. And I think with Nancy Pelosi's visit, didn't do much to ratchet that down.
That's right.
I think we're like, oh yeah, you want to cause some trouble internationally? Okay, let's send that Nancy Pelosi to Taiwan. I don't think that was a great move, you know, ultimately in terms of this escalatory thing. And I think we have to understand the pressure that Xi's under probably domestically. There's a party congress coming up, I think, in October, November, where they're going to – obviously he's going to seek another term. He's undoubtedly going to get it. The question is sort of what the tone of that discussion is going to be, what the priorities that are going to come out of that in terms of security doctrine or national strategy stuff, and Clearly, one China is still going to be the controlling policy, and how we play in and recognize that, that's the big challenge, I think.
Yeah, we've heard the U.S. government say, hey, look, our one China policy has never changed.
Yeah.
But the way the Chinese have interpreted it internationally has changed.
Right.
And that's where the conflict is coming. Yeah, do you buy that? I mean, you're a sort of an international law scholar as well.
I do. So there are a couple of ways for me to read this situation. From an international law perspective, I'm looking at the situation and watching kind of Greg's comment about it all is going to come down to energy here.
Yeah.
And China's looking to find some additional energy, especially in the current world, right? As things are looking pretty messy. And so as they start to build islands and make sure that their exclusive economic zones spread out as far as they possibly can, I think what we're seeing here is a region of the world that was not set by clear, beautiful black lines on a map, and there were some issues that needed to be dealt with in the post-colonial world in which we were living. They were never dealt with after World War II, mm-hmm. and so China, in its interests, is moving in one direction, and the U.S. is still playing by a set of rules that were developed after World War II, and we're seeing this kind of conflict now.
It's also a region where, you know, international organizations didn't develop to the way they did the West.
That's,
you know,
right.
ASEAN has never really been anything like the EU,
no.
despite aspirations, right? And so the sort of the thickness of the international regimes and law and organization just hasn't been present.
Yep.
And it's opened an opportunity, I think, for China to try to rewrite it. And they have the power now to try to do that, and I think that's what they really want to do. Again, it's the spheres of influence thing we get back to.
It is, yeah. And I think that's been a failing of U.S. foreign policy in that region for a long time, because yeah. I think we've always played with a veneer of institutionalism in that region without ever really looking deeply into those institutions yeah. and how those are not very well yeah. developed.
Right.
One of the things that I think is really interesting, like, I mean, if you look at Russia and China as being sort of the two main challenges strategically for the United States and the world right now. And we mentioned this, you know, in the green room, quote unquote, before we came in here, I mentioned that, you know, Russia in the old days, under the Soviet Union days, the general secretary of the Communist Party, the head of the Russian state, the Soviet state, had strong limits on his power and what he was allowed to do. And in Russia today, Putin has no limits on him. Well, those limitations on Xi Jinping are still there. I mean, there are strong limitations on what he is allowed to do, specifically what he can order. So there's, and China has always been a nation that's very strongly, they're focused on mercantilism. they want to do business, and anything that disrupts that is bad for business. And so they know that a war over Taiwan is a really bad idea. But and you mentioned it earlier, that's running head on right now. I mean, it's a full on collision with the Chinese nationalism
right.
that has been stoked by Xi Jinping and sort of the strong nationalists inside the Chinese Communist Party. So how does this play out? I mean, what do you think?
John, first, that's a great question.
I try.
I think you set that up really well, though, because the limitations, but the nationalist voice
right.
are an interesting set of issues to deal with, Greg.
I think we have to, you know, give Xi some kind of win. You know,
he's got to save face somehow.
He's got to save face somehow. You know, something that's not too costly for us. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's diplomatic. Maybe it's a stronger recognition of the one China, a clearer articulation that we expect someday to Taiwan to be unified with China. Who's in charge at that point? We don't know. You know, But Chinese nationalism is a new part of it.
It really is.
Ever since, you know, Deng Xiaoping, it's been, hey, let's worry less about the ideology and worry more about the development. We want development first. Mm-hmm. And then once, you know, we've got the factors of production in place, we can think about what our position in the world is now. And I think they got to the point where they're like, well, our position in the world is pretty strong. And now nationalism's playing a role. And that's, I suppose, something we might have anticipated occurring in some ways, but it does add a dangerous dimension to the dynamic, because it's not just about making sure China's developing. Now it's satisfying some of their geopolitical goals.
And that's true. They've never really been interested in sort of influencing events around the world, but that has become a significant part of their foreign policy. Yeah. I mean, if you, we just talked about it a little while ago, their influence in Africa. I mean, when I got married a little over 15 years ago, my wife and I were in Antigua, and you saw Chinese development being supported down there, roads and bridges and schools and hospital clinics and things like that across across the Caribbean. So the Chinese have been doing that. They've been trying to render influence around the world. If you look at China, I mean, there's they're trying to influence the world norms, right? We talked a little while ago about this fight, you know, that is now above the table between the liberal democratic order and the rising autocracies. If you look at what's happening inside China with the Uyghurs, with the crackdown in Hong Kong, with the social credit score that everybody has, and the surveillance state that they have created, you know, the liberal democracies, do we want China to write the next set of rules for the international order? And if you look at what they're doing internally in their country, I think there's a lot of concern there.
Yeah.
So how do we ratchet things down but contain China in a way that doesn't cause them to say, we have to lash out, right? We only have a couple minutes left. Maybe each of you give a minute and a half, couple minutes, thoughts on this?
Well, okay. I don't know. I mean, that's a really good point. I think if I could just bring it back to Russia for just one moment. So if we look at just the kind of the balance sheet of these two states and we look at what things are going to look like moving forward, Russia has demonstrated in its land forces a real incapacity.
Yeah. Totally incompetent.
Right.
Yeah, that's a nice way of putting it. Yeah. But they have a very large number of nuclear weapons.
They do.
Yeah. And so we're looking at a state that is going to have very little influence on the ground. And I don't just mean on the battlefield. I mean on the ground economically after this and on the ground politically after this. But they've got that one little wild card. Yeah. China, on the other hand, while yes, its economy has matured to a point where it's not going to be as dynamic in the future as it has been, it has capacity to grow in a way that Russia doesn't. It will be shrinking.
Yeah.
And so I think that what we're looking at long term, after the Russia-Ukraine settles out, long term is we're looking at the exact question that you just left us with, John.
Yeah, it's interesting. The Cold War was a contest between two models, right, in some ways, right? And we wanted to win the propaganda war and the war for hearts and minds over, hey, you want to be liberal democracy. You want to be in the market system, right? Look at the benefits of being in this world with us. China is offering an alternative world, right? And the Chinese values are less about human rights and democracy and more about just pure economic development, and they're going to drive that in Africa. And I think we need to get back on the, hey, you want to be part of the liberal democratic world. If we're going to win that contest, it's not going to be one that we win militarily, right? We're going to have to win it in terms of values and ideas, and we're going to have to perform. We're going to have to perform for those countries and help them to develop politically and economically.
Yeah. Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see how the Chinese Communist Party decides to move forward, you know, in China. I mean, there's going to be a huge backlash over the COVID lockdown policies that they've had because they have really negatively impacted hundreds of millions of people in China. Yep. So that will have an impact. Unfortunately, we are right up against the end of our hour today. We're coming to the end of today's edition of National Security This Week. Professor Greg Marfleet from Carleton College and Professor Tony Lott from the College of St. Olaf, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
For having us.
Yeah. Really, your time today, this has been a great discussion. It's been fun.
There's
some great insights here. I hope our listeners really enjoyed hearing what you had to say. Tony, what courses are you teaching this fall term?
Well, I have a senior seminar in diplomacy, so we'll be talking about lots of the issues we just talked about, and then a course in what is called the Environmental Conversations, so it's a first-year program.
Ooh. Okay. And Greg,
I'm teaching the mandatory methods course for our students, so I'm in the statistics. But I'm also teaching a senior seminar called Foreign Policy Analysis, which is basically a look at how internal processes affect the way states act internationally. And one of the case studies we're going to do is Putin, We're going to spend a little time about Putin's personality and his belief systems. And so there's been some interesting writing on him. He's certainly a figure that merits some discussion and analysis. So we'll be doing that.
Yeah, there's a huge impact on the domestic policy scene on how nations craft their foreign policy agenda. So, and folks, that closes this week's edition of National Security This Week. I'm your host, John Olson. Thank you for joining us today. Look forward to sharing time with you again next Wednesday morning at 9 a.m. Thank you for listening to National Security This Week. And if you like this show, make sure you tune in to Public Policy This Week every Friday morning at 10 a.m. Have a great finish to your week, everybody. Take care.
You've been listening to National Security This Week, a weekly show looking into issues of American national security with the host, John Olson. Listen every Wednesday at 9 a.m. for National Security This Week.